It itched him some when that finger started coming. Kept me awake nights, Roy Delphine said. But he knowed it was the Lord's itch, and let it be. Praise Jesus, the Lord is mighty. Roy Delphine's story was only one of many. I grew up in a tradition of miracles and healings. I grew up believing in Grigri as well. Only up in the hills we set it to rhyme with kiss, kiss. Stump water for warts, moss under your pillow to ease the heartache of lost love, and, of course, what we used to call haints. But I did not believe John Coffey was a Grigri man. I had looked into his eyes. More importantly, I had felt his touch. Being touched by him was like being touched by some strange and wonderful doctor. I helped it, didn't I? That kept chiming in my head, like a snatch of song you can't get rid of, or words you'd speak to set a spell. I helped it, didn't I? Except he hadn't. God had. John Coffey's use of I could be chalked up to ignorance rather than pride, but I knew, believed at least, what I had learned about healing in those churches of Praise Jesus, the Lord is Mighty, Piney Woods Amen Corners, much beloved by my 22-year-old mother and my aunts, that healing is never about the healed or the healer, but about God's will. For one to rejoice that the sick made well is normal. Quite the expected thing. But the person healed has an obligation to then ask why. To meditate on God's will and the extraordinary lengths to which God has gone to realize his will. What did God want of me in this case? What did he want badly enough to put healing power in the hands of a child murderer? To be on the block? Instead of at home, sick as a dog, shivering in bed with the stink of sulfur running out of my pores? Perhaps. I was maybe supposed to be here, instead of home, in case Wild Bill Wharton decided to kick up more Dickens, or to make sure Percy Wetmore didn't get up to some foolish and potentially destructive piece of fuckery. All right, then. So be it. I would keep my eyes open, and my mouth shut, especially about miracle cures. No one was apt to question my looking and sounding better. I'd been telling the world I was getting better, and until that very day, I'd honestly believed it. I'd even told Warden Moores that I was on the mend. Delacroix had seen something, but I thought he would keep his mouth shut, too, probably afraid John Coffey would throw a spell on him if he didn't. As for Coffey himself, he'd probably already forgotten it. He was nothing but a conduit, after all, and there isn't a culvert in the world that remembers the water that flowed through it once the rain has stopped. So I resolved to keep my mouth completely shut on the subject, with never an idea of how soon I'd be telling the story, or who I'd be telling it to. But I was curious about my big boy, and there's no sense not admitting it. After what had happened to me there in his cell, I was more curious than ever. Chapter 4. Before leaving that night, I arranged with Brutal to cover for me the next day should I come in a little late, and when I got up the following morning, I set out for Tefton, down in Trepingus County.
"I'm not sure I like you worrying so much about this fella Coffey," my wife said, handing me the lunch she'd put up for me.
Janice never believed in roadside hamburger stands. She used to say there was a bellyache waiting in every one.
"It's not like you, Paul."
"I'm not worried about him," I said. "I'm curious, that's all."
"In my experience, one leads to the other,"
Janice said tartly, then gave me a good hearty kiss on the mouth.
"You look better, at least, I'll say that. For a while there you had me nervous. Waterworks all better?"
"All better," I said. And off I went, singing songs like Come Josephine in my flying machine, and We're in the Money, to keep myself company. I went to the offices of the Tefton Intelligencer first, and they told me that Bert Hammersmith, the fellow I was looking for, was most likely over at the county courthouse. At the courthouse, they told me that Hammersmith had been there but had left when a burst water pipe had closed down the main proceedings, which happened to be a rape trial. In the pages of the Intelligencer, the crime would be referred to as assault on a woman, which was how such things were done in the days before Ricky Lake and Carney Wilson came on the scene. They guessed he'd probably gone on home. I got some directions out a dirt road, so rutted and narrow I just about didn't dare take my Ford up it, and there I found my man. Hammersmith had written most of the stories on the coffee trial, and it was from him I found out most of the details about the brief manhunt that had netted Coffee in the first place. The details the Intelligencer considered too gruesome to print, is what I mean, of course. Mrs. Hammersmith was a young woman with a tired, pretty face, and hands red from lye soap. She didn't ask my business, just led me through a small house fragrant with the smell of baking and onto the back porch, where her husband sat with a bottle of pop in his hand and an unopened copy of Liberty magazine on his lap. There was a small, sloping backyard. At the foot of it, two little ones were squabbling and laughing over a swing. From the porch it was impossible to tell their sexes, but I thought they were boy and girl, maybe even twins, which cast an interesting sort of light on their father's part, peripheral as it had been, in the coffee trial. Nearer at hand, set like an island in the middle of a turd-studded patch of bare, beat-up-looking ground, was a doghouse. No sign of Fido. It was another unseasonably hot day, and I guessed he was probably inside snoozing.
"Birchew, I'll got you a company,"
Mrs. Hammersmith said.
"All right,"
he said. He glanced at me, glanced at his wife, then looked back at his kids, which was where his heart obviously lay. He was a thin man, almost painfully thin, as if he had just begun to recover from a serious illness, and his hair had started to recede. His wife touched his shoulder tentatively with one of her red, wash-swollen hands. He didn't look at it or reach up to touch it, and after a moment she took it back. It occurred to me fleetingly that they looked more like brother and sister than husband and wife. He'd gotten the brain, she'd gotten the looks, but neither of them had escaped some underlying resemblance, a heredity that could never be escaped. Later, going home, I realized they didn't look alike at all. What made them seem to was the aftermath of stress and the lingering of sorrow. It's strange how pain marks our faces and makes us look like family. She said,
"Y'all want a cold drink, Mr.?
It's Edgecombe," I said, "Paul Edgecombe, and thank you, a cold drink would be wonderful, ma'am." She went back inside. I held out my hand to Hammersmith, who gave it a brief shake. His grip was limp and cold. He never took his eyes off the kids down at the bottom of the yard. "Mr. Hammersmith, I'm E-Block Superintendent at Cold Mountain State Prison."
"That's, I know what it is,"
he said, looking at me with a little more interest.
"So, the bull goose screw of the Green Mile is standing on my back porch just as big as life. What brings you 50 miles to talk to the local rag's only full-time reporter?"
"John Coffey," I said. I think I expected some sort of strong reaction, the kids who could have been twins working at the back of my mind, and perhaps the doghouse, too, the Dedericks had had a dog. But Hammersmith only raised his eyebrows and sipped at his drink.
"Coffee's your problem now, isn't he?"
Hammersmith asked. "He's not much of a problem," I said. "He doesn't like the dark, and he cries a lot of the time, but neither thing makes much of a problem in our line of work. We see worse."
"Cries a lot, does he?"
Hammersmith asked.
"Well, he's got a lot to cry about, I'd say, considering what he did."
"What do you want to know?" "Anything you can tell me. I've read your newspaper stories, so I guess what I want is anything that wasn't in them." He gave me a sharp, dry look.
"Like how the little girls looked?
Like exactly what he did to them?
That the kind of stuff you're interested in, Mr. Edgecombe?"
"No,"
I said, keeping my voice mild. It's not the Dederick girls I'm interested in, sir. Poor little mites are dead. But Coffee's not. Not yet. And I'm curious about him.
All right, he said. Pull up a chair and sit, Mr. Edgecombe. You'll forgive me if I sounded a little sharp just now, but I get to see plenty of vultures in my line of work. Hell, I've been accused of being one of them often enough myself. I just wanted to make sure of you.
And are you?
Sure enough, I guess,
he said, sounding almost indifferent. The story he told me is pretty much the one I set down earlier in this account. How Mrs. Dederick found the porch empty, with the screen door pulled off its upper hinge, the blankets cast into one corner, and blood on the steps. How her son and husband had taken after the girl's abductor, how the posse had caught up to them first and to John Coffey not much later. How Coffey had been sitting on the river bank and wailing, with the bodies curled in his massive arms like big dolls. The reporter, rack-thin in his open-collared white shirt and gray town pants, spoke in a low, unemotional voice. But his eyes never left his own two children as they squabbled and laughed and took turns with the swing down there in the shade at the foot of the slope. Sometime in the middle of the story, Mrs. Hammersmith came back with a bottle of homemade root beer, cold and strong and delicious. She stood listening for a while, then interrupted long enough to call down to the kids and tell them to come up directly. She had cookies due out of the oven.
"We will, Mama,"
called a little girl's voice, and the woman went back inside again. When Hammersmith had finished, he said,
"So why do you want to know? I never had me a visit from a big-house screw before. It's a first."
"I told you.
Curiosity,
yeah.
Folks get curious, I know it. I even thank God for it. I'd be out of a job and might actually have to go to work for a living without it. But 50 miles is a long way to come to satisfy a simple curiosity, especially when the last 20 is over bad roads. So why don't you tell me the truth, Edgecombe? I satisfied yours, so now you satisfy mine."
"Well, I could say. I had this urinary infection, and John Coffey put his hands on me and healed it. The man who raped and murdered those two little girls did that. So I wondered about him, of course. Anyone would. I even wondered if maybe Homer Kribus and Deputy Rob McGee didn't maybe collar the wrong man. In spite of all the evidence against him, I wonder that, because a man who has a power like that in his hands, you don't usually think of him as the kind of man who rapes and murders children." "No, maybe that wouldn't do." "There are two things I've wondered about," I said. "The first is if he ever did anything like that before." Hammersmith turned to me, his eyes suddenly sharp and bright with interest, and I saw he was a smart fellow. Maybe even a brilliant fellow in a quiet way.
"Why?" he asked. "What do you know, Edgecombe? What has he said?"
"Nothing. But a man who does this sort of thing once has usually done it before. They get a taste for it."
"Yes," he said. "They do. They certainly do."
"And it occurred to me that it would be easy enough to follow his back trail and find out. A man his size and a Negro to boot can't be that hard to trace."
"You'd think so. Well, you'd be wrong," he said. "In Coffey's case, anyhow, I know."
"You tried?"
"I did, and came up all but empty. There were a couple of railroad fellas who thought they saw him in the Knoxville yards 2 days before the Dederick girls were killed. No surprise there, he was just across the river from the Great Southern Tracks when they collared him, and that's probably how he came down here from Tennessee. I got a letter from a man who said he'd hired a big, bald black man to shift crates for him in the early spring of this year. This was in Kentucky. I sent him a picture of Coffee, and he said that was the man. But other than that..."
Hammersmith shrugged and shook his head. "Doesn't that strike you as a little odd?"
"Strikes me as a lot odd, Mr. Edgecombe. It's like he dropped out of the sky. And he's no help. He can't remember last week once this week comes."
"No, he can't," I said. "How do you explain it?" "We're in a depression," he said. "That's how I explain it. People all over the roads. The Okies want to pick peaches in California. The poor whites from up in the breaks want to build cars in Detroit. The black folks from Mississippi want to go up to New England and work in the shoe factories or the textile mills. Everyone, black as well as white, thinks it's going to be better over the next jump of land. It's the American damn way. Even a giant like Coffee doesn't get noticed everywhere he goes. Until, that is, he decides to kill a couple of little girls. Little white girls. Do you believe that?" I asked. He gave me a bland look from his too thin face. "Sometimes I do," he said. His wife leaned out of the kitchen window like an engineer from the cab of a locomotive and called, "Kids, cookies are ready." She turned to me. "Would you like an oatmeal raisin cookie, Mr. Edgecombe?" "I'm sure they're delicious, ma'am, but I'll take a pass this time." "All right," she said, and drew her head back inside. "Have you seen the scars on him?" Hammersmith asked abruptly. He was still watching his kids, who couldn't quite bring themselves to abandon the pleasures of the swing, not even for oatmeal raisin cookies. "Yes," but I was surprised he had. He saw my reaction and laughed. The defense attorney's one big victory was getting Coffee to take off his shirt and show those scarves to the jury. The prosecutor, George Peterson, objected like hell, but the judge allowed it. Old George could have saved his breath. Juries around these parts don't buy all that psychology crap about how people who have been mistreated just can't help themselves. They believe people can help themselves. It's a point of view I have a lot of sympathy for, but those scars were pretty ghastly just the same. Notice anything about him, Edgecombe? I had seen the man naked in the shower, and I'd noticed all right. I knew just what he was talking about. They're all broken up. Latticed, almost. You know what that means? Somebody whopped the living hell out of him when he was a kid, I said, before he grew. But they didn't manage to whop the devil out of him, did they, Edgecombe? Should have spared the rod and just drowned him in the river like a stray kitten, don't you think? I suppose it would have been politic to simply agree and get out of there, but I couldn't. I'd seen him. And I'd felt him as well, felt the touch of his hands. "He's strange," I said. "But there doesn't seem to be any real violence in him. I know how he was found, and it's hard to jibe that with what I see day in and day out on the block. I know violent men, Mr. Hammersmith. It was Wharton I was thinking about, of course. Wharton strangling Dean Stanton with his wrist chain and bellowing, "Hee-hee, boys, ain't this a party now?" He was looking at me closely now and smiling a little incredulous smile that I didn't care for very much. "You didn't come up here to get an idea about whether or not he might have killed some other little girl somewhere else," he said. "You came up here to see if I think he did it at all. That's it, isn't it? Fess up, Edgecombe." I swallowed the last of my cold drink, put the bottle down next to his on the little table, and said, "Well, do you?" "Kids," he called down the hill, leaning forward a little in his chair to do it. "Y'all come on up here now and get your cookies." Then he leaned back in his chair again and looked at me. That little smile, the one I didn't much care for, had reappeared. "Tell you something," he said. "You want to listen close, too, because this might just be something you need to know." "I'm listening." "We had us a dog, named Sir Galahad," he said, and cocked a thumb at the doghouse. "A good dog. No particular breed, but gentle, calm, ready to lick your hand or fetch a stick. There are plenty of mongrel dogs like him, wouldn't you say?" I shrugged, nodded. "In many ways, a good mongrel dog is like your negro," he said. "You get to know it, and often you grow to love it. It is of no particular use, but you keep it around because you think it loves you. If you're lucky, Mr. Edgecombe, you never have to find out any different. Cynthia and I, we were not lucky." He sighed, a long and somehow skeletal sound, like the wind rummaging through fallen leaves. He pointed toward the doghouse again, and I wondered how I had missed its general air of abandonment earlier, or the fact that many of the turds had grown whitish and powdery at their tops.
"I used to clean up after him," Hammersmith said, "and keep the roof of his house repaired against the rain, and that way also Sir Galahad was like your southern negro, who will not do those things for himself. Now I don't touch it. I haven't been near it since the accident, if you can call it an accident. I went over there with my rifle and shot him. But I haven't been over there since. I can't bring myself to. I suppose I will in time. I'll clean up his messes and tear down his house."
Here came the kids. And all at once I didn't want them to come. All at once that was the last thing on earth I wanted. The little girl was all right. But the boy... They pounded up the steps, looked at me, giggled, then went on toward the kitchen door.
"Caleb," Hammersmith said, "come here, just for a second."
The little girl, surely his twin, they had to be of an age, about 4, went on into the kitchen. The little boy came to his father, looking down at his feet. He knew he was ugly. He was only 4, I guess, but 4 is old enough to know that you're ugly. His father put 2 fingers under the boy's chin and tried to raise his face. At first the boy resisted, but when his father said, "Please, son," in tones of sweetness and calmness and love, he did as he was asked. A huge circular scar ran out of his hair, down his forehead, through one dead and indifferently cocked eye, and to the corner of his mouth, which had been disfigured into the knowing leer of a gambler or perhaps a whoremaster. One cheek was smooth and pretty, the other was bunched up like the stump of a tree. I guess there had been a hole in it, but that at least had healed.
"He has the one eye,"
Hammersmith said, caressing the boy's bunched cheek with a lover's kind fingers.
"I suppose he's lucky not to be blind. We get down on our knees and thank God for that much at least, eh, Caleb?"
"Yes, sir,"
the boy said shyly. The boy who would be beaten mercilessly on the play yard by laughing, jeering bullies for all his miserable years of education. The boy who would never be asked to play spin the bottle or post office, and would probably never sleep with a woman not bought and paid for once he was grown to manhood's times and needs. The boy who would always stand outside the warm and lighted circle of his peers. The boy who would look at himself in his mirror for the next 50 or 60 or 70 years of his life and think, "Ugly, ugly, ugly."
"Go on in and get your cookies,"
his father said, and kissed his son's sneering mouth.
"Yes, sir,"
Caleb said and dashed inside. Hammersmith took a handkerchief from his back pocket and wiped at his eyes with it. They were dry, but I suppose he'd gotten used to them being wet.
"The dog was here when they were born," he said. "I brought him in the house to smell them when Cynthia brought them home from the hospital, and Sir Galahad licked their hands, their little hands."
He nodded as if confirming this to himself.
"He played with them. Used to lick Arden's face until she giggled. Caleb used to pull his ears, and when he was first learning to walk, he'd sometimes go around the yard holding Galahad's tail. The dog never so much as growled at him, either of them."
Now the tears were coming. He wiped at them automatically, as a man does when he's had lots of practice.
"There was no reason," he said. "Caleb didn't hurt him, yell at him, anything. I know, I was there. If I hadn't been, the boy would almost certainly have been killed. What happened, Mr. Edgecombe, was nothing. The boy just got his face set the right way in front of the dog's face, and it came into Sir Galahad's mind, whatever serves a dog for a mind, to lunge and bite, to kill if he could. The boy was there in front of him, and the dog bit. And that's what happened with Coffee. He was there, he saw them on the porch, he took them, he raped them, he killed them. You say there should be some hint that he did something like it before, and I know what you mean, but maybe he didn't do it before. My dog never bit before, just that once.
Maybe if Coffee was let go, he'd never do it again. Maybe my dog never would have bit again, but I didn't concern myself with that, you know. I went out with my rifle and grabbed his collar and blew his head off. He was breathing hard. I'm as enlightened as the next man, Mr. Edgecombe. Went to college in Bowling Green, took history as well as journalism, some philosophy, too. I like to think of myself as enlightened. I don't suppose folks up north would, but I like to think of myself as enlightened. I'd not bring slavery back for all the tea in China. I think we have to be humane and generous in our efforts to solve the race problem, but we have to remember that your Negro will bite if he gets the chance, just like a mongrel dog will bite if he gets a chance, and it crosses his mind to do so. You want to know if he did it? Your weepy Mr. Coffee with the scars all over him? I nodded. Oh, yes, Hammersmith said. He did it. Don't you doubt it, and don't you turn your back on him. You might get away with it once, or 100 times, even 1,000, but in the end... He raised a hand before my eyes and snapped the fingers together rapidly against the thumb, turning the hand into a biting mouth. You understand? I nodded again. He raped them. He killed them, and afterward he was sorry. But those little girls stayed raped. Those little girls stayed dead. But you'll fix him, won't you, Edgecombe? In a few weeks you'll fix him so he never does anything like that again. He got up, went to the porch rail, and looked vaguely at the doghouse standing at the center of its beaten patch in the middle of those aging turds. "Perhaps you'll excuse me," he said. "Since I don't have to spend the afternoon in court, I thought I might visit with my family for a little bit. A man's children are only young once." "You go ahead," I said. My lips felt numb and distant. "And thank you for your time." "Don't mention it," he said. I drove directly from Hammersmith's house to the prison. It was a long drive, and this time I wasn't able to shorten it by singing songs. It felt like all the songs had gone out of me, at least for a while. I kept seeing that poor little boy's disfigured face, and Hammersmith's hand, the fingers going up and down against the thumb in a biting motion. Chapter 5. Wild Bill Wharton took his first trip down to the restraint room the very next day. He spent the morning and afternoon being as quiet and good as Mary's little lamb, a state we soon discovered was not natural with him and meant trouble. Then, around 7:30 that evening, Harry felt something warm splash on the cuffs of uniform pants he had put on clean just that day. It was piss. William Wharton was standing at his cell, showing his darkening teeth in a wide grin, and pissing all over Harry Terwilliger's pants and shoes.
"The dirty son of a bitch must have been saving it up all day," Harry said later, still disgusted and outraged.
Well, that was it. It was time to show William Wharton who ran the show on E-Block. Harry got brutal, and me, and I alerted Dean and Percy, who were also on. We had 3 prisoners by then, remember, and were into what we called full coverage, with my group on from 7 in the evening to 3 in the morning, when trouble was most apt to break out, and 2 other crews covering the rest of the day. Those other crews consisted mostly of floaters, with Bill Dodge usually in charge. It wasn't a bad way to run things, all in all, and I felt that once I could shift Percy over to Days, life would be even better. I never got around to that, however. I sometimes wonder if it would have changed things if I had. Anyway, there was a big water main in the storage room on the side away from old Sparky, and Dean and Percy hooked up a length of canvas fire hose to it. Then they stood by the valve that would open it if needed. Brutal and I hurried down to Wharton's cell, where Wharton still stood, still grinning and still with his tool hanging out of his pants. I had liberated the straitjacket from the restraint room and tossed it on a shelf in my office last thing before going home the night before, thinking we might be needing it for our new problem child. Now I had it in one hand, my index finger hooked under one of the canvas straps. Harry came behind us, hauling the nozzle of the fire hose, which ran back through my office, down the storage room steps, and to the drum where Dean and Percy were paying it out as fast as they could.
"Hey, y'all like that?"
Wild Bill asked. He was laughing like a kid at a carnival, laughing so hard he could barely talk. Big tears went rolling down his cheeks.
You come on so fast, I guess you must have. I'm currently cooking some turds to go with it. Nice soft ones. I'll have them out to y'all tomorrow.
He saw that I was unlocking his cell door, and his eyes narrowed. He saw that Brutal was holding his revolver in one hand and his nightstick in the other, and they narrowed even more.
You can come in here on your legs, but you go out on your backs. Billy the Kid is going to guarantee you that,
he told us. His eyes shifted back to me.
And if you think you're going to put that nut coat on me, you got another thing coming, old hoss.
You're not the one who says go or jump back around here, I told him. You should know that, but I guess you're too dumb to pick it up without a little teaching. I finished unlocking the door and ran it back on its track. Wharton retreated to the bunk, his cock still hanging out of his pants, put his hands out to me, palms up, then beckoned with his fingers.
Come on, you ugly motherfucker, he said. They be schooling all right, but this old boy's well set up to be the teacher.
He shifted his gaze and his dark-toothed grin to Brutal.
Come on, big fella, you first. This time you can't sneak up behind me. Put down that gun, you ain't gonna shoot it anyway, not you. And we'll go man to man. See who's the better fella.
Brutal stepped into the cell, but not toward Wharton. He moved to the left once he was through the door, and Wharton's narrow eyes widened as he saw the fire hose pointed at him.
No, you don't, he said. Oh, no, you don't.
Dean, I yelled. Turn it on all the way. Wharton jumped forward, and Brutal hit him a good smart lick, the kind of lick I'm sure Percy dreamed of, across his forehead, laying his baton right over Wharton's eyebrows. Wharton, who seemed to think we'd never seen trouble until we'd seen him, went to his knees, his eyes open but blind. Then the water came, Harry staggering back a step under its power, and then holding steady, the nozzle firm in his hands, pointed like a gun. The stream caught Wild Bill Wharton square in the middle of his chest, spun him halfway around, and drove him back under his bunk. Down the hall, Delacroix was jumping from foot to foot, cackling shrilly and cursing at John Coffey, demanding that Coffey tell him what was going on, who was winning, and how that grand fou new boy liked that Chinese water treatment. John said nothing, just stood there quietly in his two short pants and his prison slippers. I only had one quick glance at him, but that was enough to observe his same old expression, both sad and serene. It was as if he'd seen the whole thing before, not just once or twice, but 1,000 times.
"Kill the water!"
Brutal shouted back over his shoulder, then raced forward into the cell. He sank his hands into the semi-conscious Wharton's armpits and dragged him out from under his bunk. Wharton was coughing and making a glub-glub sound. Blood was dribbling into his dazed eyes from above his brows, where Brutal's stick had popped the skin open in a line. We had the straitjacket business down to a science, did Brutus Howell and me. We'd practiced it like a couple of vaudeville hoofers working up a new dance routine. Every now and then, that practice paid off. Now, for instance. Brutal sat Wharton up and held out his arms toward me the way a kid might hold out the arms of a Raggedy Andy doll. Awareness was just starting to seep back into Wharton's eyes, the knowledge that if he didn't start fighting right away, it was going to be too late. But the lines were still down between his brain and his muscles, and before he could repair them, I had rammed the sleeves of the coat up his arms, and Brutal was doing the buckles up the back. While he took care of that, I grabbed the cuff straps, pulled Wharton's arms around his sides, and linked his wrists together with another canvas strap. He ended up looking like he was hugging himself.
"God damn you, big dummy! How they doing with him?"
Delacroix screamed. I heard Mr. Jingles squeaking, as if he wanted to know, too. Percy arrived, his shirt wet and sticking to him from his struggles with the water main, his face glowing with excitement. Dean came along behind him, wearing a bracelet of purplish bruise around his throat and looking a lot less thrilled. "Come on now, Wild Bill," I said, and yanked Wharton to his feet. "Little walkie-walkie."
"Don't you call me that!"
Wharton screamed shrilly, and I think that for the first time we were seeing real feelings and not just a clever animal's camouflage spots.
"Wild Bill Hickok wasn't no range rider. He never fought him no bear with a bowie knife, either. He was just another bushwhacking John Law. Dumb son of a bitch sat with his back to the door and got killed by a drunk."
"Oh, my suds and body, a history lesson," Brutal exclaimed and shoved Wharton out of his cell. "A fella just never knows what he's going to get when he clocks in here, only that it's apt to be nice. But with so many nice people like you around, I guess that kind of stands to reason, don't it? And you know what? Pretty soon you'll be history yourself, Wild Bill. Meantime, you get on down the hall. We got a room for you. Kind of a cooling-off room." Wharton gave a furious, inarticulate scream and threw himself at Brutal, even though he was snugly buckled into the coat now and his arms were wrapped around behind him. Percy made to draw his baton, the Wetmore solution for all of life's problems, and Dean put a hand on his wrist. Percy gave him a puzzled, half-indignant look, as if to say that after what Wharton had done to Dean, Dean should be the last person in the world to want to hold him back. Brutal pushed Wharton backward. I caught him and pushed him to Harry. And Harry propelled him on down the Green Mile, past the staring Delacroix and the impassive coffee. Wharton ran to keep from falling on his face, spitting curses the whole way, spitting them the way a welder's torch spits sparks. We banged him into the last cell on the right while Dean, Harry, and Percy, who for once wasn't complaining about being unfairly overworked, yanked all of the crap out of the restraint room. While they did that, I had a brief conversation with Wharton. "You think you're tough," I said. "And maybe you are, Sonny, but in here tough don't matter. Your stampeding days are over. If you take it easy on us, we'll take it easy on you. If you make it hard, you'll die in the end just the same, but we'll sharpen you like a pencil before you go."
"You're gonna be so happy to see the end of me," Wharton said in a hoarse voice.
He was struggling against the straitjacket, even though he must have known it would do no good, and his face was red as a tomato.
"And until I'm gone, I'll make your lives miserable."
He bared his teeth at me like an angry baboon. "If that's all you want, to make our lives miserable, you can quit now, because you've already succeeded," Brutal said. "But as far as your time on the mile goes, Wharton, we don't care if you spend all of it in the room with the soft walls. And you can wear that damn nut coat until your arms gangrene from lack of circulation and fall right off." He paused. "No one much comes down here, you know. And if you think anyone gives much of a shit what happens to you one way or another, you best reconsider, cowboy. To the world in general, you're already one dead outlaw." Wharton was studying Brutal carefully, and the collar was fading out of his face.
"Let me out of it,"
he said in a placatory voice, a voice too sane and too reasonable to trust.
"I'll be good, honest Injun."
Harry appeared in the cell doorway. The end of the corridor looked like a rummage sale, but we'd set things to rights with good speed once we got started. We had before. We knew the drill.
"All ready,"
Harry said. Brutal grabbed the bulge in the canvas where Wharton's right elbow was and yanked him to his feet.
"Come on, Wild Billy, and look on the good side. You're going to have at least 24 hours to remind yourself never to sit with your back to the door and never to hold on to no aces and eights."
"Let me out of it," Wharton said.
He looked from Brutal to Harry to me, the red creeping back into his face.
"I'll be good. I'll tell you, I've learned my lesson.
He suddenly collapsed, half of him in the cell, half of him on the played-out lino of the Green Mile, kicking his feet and bucking his body.
"Holy Christ, he's pitching a fit,"
Percy whispered.
"Sure. And my sister's the Whore of Babylon," Brutal said.
"She dances the hoochie-coochie for Moses on Saturday nights in a long white veil." He bent down and hooked a hand into one of Wharton's armpits. I got the other one. Wharton threshed between us like a hooked fish. Carrying his jerking body, listening to him grunt from one end and fart from the other, was one of my life's less pleasant experiences. I looked up and met John Coffey's eyes for a second. They were bloodshot, and his dark cheeks were wet. He had been crying again. I thought of Hammersmith making that biting gesture with his hand and shivered a little. Then I turned my attention back to Wharton. We threw him into the restraint room like he was cargo.
and watched him lie on the floor, bucking hard in the straitjacket, next to the drain we had once checked for the mouse which had started its Block E life as Steamboat Willie.
"I don't much care if he swallows his tongue or something and dies," Dean said in his hoarse and raspy voice. "But think of the paperwork, boys. It'd never end."
"Never mind the paperwork. Think of the hearing," Harry said gloomily. "We'd lose our damn jobs. End up picking peas down Mississippi. You know what Mississippi is, don't you? It's the Indian word for asshole."
"He ain't gonna die, and he ain't gonna swallow his tongue either," Brutal said. "When we open this door tomorrow, he's gonna be just fine. Take my word for it."
That's just the way it was, too. The man we took back to his cell the next night at 9 was quiet, pallid, and seemingly chastened. He walked with his head down, made no effort to attack anyone when the straitjacket came off, and only stared listlessly at me when I told him it would go just the same the next time, and he just had to ask himself how much time he wanted to spend pissing in his pants and eating baby food a spoonful at a time.
"I'll be good, boss. I learnt my lesson,"
he whispered in a humble little voice as we put him back in his cell. Brutal looked at me and winked. Late the next day, William Wharton, who was Billy the Kid to himself, and never that bushwhacking John Law Wild Bill Hickok, bought a moon pie from old Toot-Toot. He had been expressly forbidden any such commerce, but the afternoon crew was composed of floaters, as I think I have said, and the deal went down. Toot himself undoubtedly knew better, but to him the snack wagon was always a case of a nickel is a nickel, a dime is a dime. I'd sing another chorus, but I don't have the time. That night, when Brutal ran his check round, Wharton was standing at the door of his cell. He waited until Brutal looked up at him, then slammed the heels of his hands into his bulging cheeks and shot a thick and amazingly long stream of chocolate sludge into Brutal's face. He had crammed the entire moon pie into his trap, held it there until it liquefied, and then used it like chewing tobacco. Wharton fell back on his bunk wearing a chocolate goatee, kicking his legs and screaming with laughter, and pointing to Brutal, who was wearing a lot more than a goatee.
"Lil' Black Sambo, yassa, boss, yassa, how do you do?"
Wharton held his belly and howled,
"Gosh, if it had only been caca, I wish it had been. If I'd had me some of that..."
"You are caca," Brutal growled, "and I hope you got your bags packed, because you're going back down to your favorite toilet." Once again, Wharton was bundled into the straitjacket, and once again we stowed him in the room with the soft walls. 2 days this time. Sometimes we could hear him raving in there. Sometimes we could hear him promising that he'd be good, that he'd come to his senses and be good. And sometimes we could hear him screaming that he needed a doctor, that he was dying. Mostly, though, he was silent. And he was silent when we took him out again, too. Walking back to his cell with his head down and his eyes dull, not responding when Harry said, "Remember, it's up to you." He would be all right for a while, and then he'd try something else. There was nothing he did that hadn't been tried before. Well, except for the thing with the moon pie, maybe, even Brutal admitted, that was pretty original. But his sheer persistence was scary. I was afraid that sooner or later someone's attention might lapse and there would be hell to pay. And the situation might continue for quite a while, because somewhere he had a lawyer who was beating the bushes, telling folks how wrong it would be to kill this fella upon whose brow the dew of youth had not yet dried, and who was, incidentally, as white as John Brown. There was no sense complaining about it, because keeping Wharton out of the chair was his lawyer's job. Keeping him safely jugged was ours. And in the end, old Sparky would almost certainly have him, lawyer or no lawyer. Chapter 6. That was the week Melinda Moores, the warden's wife, came home from Indianola. The doctors were done with her. They had had their interesting, newfangled X-ray photographs of the tumor in her head. They had documented the weakness in her hand and the paralyzing pains that racked her almost constantly by then, and were done with her. They gave her husband a bunch of pills with morphine in them and sent Melinda home to die. Hal Moores had some sick leave piled up,
Not a lot, they didn't give you a lot in those days. But he took what he had so he could help her do what she had to do. My wife and I went to see her 3 days or so after she came home. I called ahead, and Hal said yes, that would be fine. Melinda was having a pretty good day and would enjoy seeing us. I hate calls like this, I said to Janice as we drove to the little house where the Moorses had spent most of their marriage.
So does everyone, honey, she said and patted my hand. We'll bear up under it, and so will she.
I hope so. We found Melinda in the sitting room, planted in a bright slant of unseasonably warm October sun, and my first shocked thought was that she had lost 90 pounds. She hadn't, of course. If she'd lost that much weight, she hardly would have been there at all. But that was my brain's initial reaction to what my eyes were reporting. Her face had fallen away to show the shape of the underlying skull, and her skin was as white as parchment. There were dark circles under her eyes, and it was the first time I ever saw her in her rocker when she didn't have a lap full of sewing or Afghan squares or rags for braiding into a rug. She was just sitting there, like a person in a train station.
Melinda,
my wife said warmly. I think she was as shocked as I was, more, perhaps. But she hid it splendidly, as some women seem able to do. She went to Melinda, dropped on one knee beside the rocking chair in which the warden's wife sat, and took one of her hands. As she did, my eye happened upon the blue hearthrug by the fireplace. It occurred to me that it should have been the shade of tired old limes, because now this room was just another version of the Green Mile.
"I brought you some tea," Jan said. "The kind I put up myself. It's a nice, sleepy tea. I've left it in the kitchen."
"Thank you so much, darling," Melinda said.
Her voice sounded old and rusty.
"How you feeling, dear?"
my wife asked.
"Better,"
Melinda said in her rusty, grating voice.
"Not so's I want to go out to a barn dance, but at least there's no pain today. They give me some pills for the headaches. Sometimes they even work."
"That's good, isn't it?
But I can't grip so well. Something's happened to my hand."
She raised it, looked at it as if she had never seen it before, and lowered it back into her lap.
"Something's happened all over me."
She began to cry in a soundless way that made me think of John Coffey. It started to chime in my head again, that thing he'd said. "I helped it, didn't I? I helped it, didn't I?" Like a rhyme you can't get rid of. Hal came in then. He collared me, and you can believe me when I say I was glad to be collared. We went into the kitchen, and he poured me half a shot of white whiskey, hot stuff, fresh out of some countryman's still. We clinked our glasses together and drank. The shine went down like coal oil, but the bloom in the belly was heaven. Still, when Moores tipped the mason jar at me, wordlessly asking if I wanted the other half, I shook my head and waved it off. Wild Bill Wharton was out of restraints, for the time being anyway, and it wouldn't be safe to go near where he was with a booze-clouded head, not even with bars between us.
"I don't know how long I can take this, Paul," he said in a low voice. "There's a girl who comes in mornings to help me with her, but the doctors say she may lose control of her bowels, and... He stopped, his throat working, trying hard not to cry in front of me again. "Go with it as best you can," I said. I reached out across the table and briefly squeezed his palsied, liver-spotted hand. "Do that day by day, and give the rest over to God. There's nothing else you can do, is there?"
"I guess not. But it's hard, Paul. I pray you never have to find out how hard."
He made an effort to collect himself.
"Now tell me the news. How are you doing with William Wharton, and how are you making out with Percy Wetmore?"
We talked shop for a while and got through the visit. After, All the way home, with my wife sitting silent for the most part, wet-eyed and thoughtful in the passenger seat beside me, Coffee's words ran around in my head like Mr. Jingles running around in Delacroix's cell. I helped it, didn't I? It's terrible, my wife said dully at one point. And there's nothing anyone can do to help her. I nodded agreement and thought, I helped it, didn't I? But that was crazy, and I tried as best I could to put it out of my mind. As we turned into our dooryard, she finally spoke a second time. Not about her old friend Melinda, but about my urinary infection. She wanted to know if it was really gone. Really gone, I told her, cured.
That's fine, then, she said,
and kissed me over the eyebrow in that shivery place of mine.
Maybe we ought to, you know, get up to a little something. If you have the time and the inclination, that is.
Having plenty of the latter and just enough of the former, I took her by the hand and led her into the back bedroom and took her clothes off as she stroked the part of me that swelled and throbbed but didn't hurt any more. And as I moved in her sweetness, slipping through it in that slow way she liked, that we both liked, I thought of John Coffey, saying he'd helped it. He'd helped it, hadn't he? Like a snatch of song that won't leave your mind until it's damned good and ready. Later, as I drove to the prison, I got to thinking that very soon we would have to start rehearsing for Delacroix's execution. That thought led to how Percy was going to be out front this time, and I felt a shiver of dread. I told myself to just go with it. One execution and we'd very likely be shut of Percy Wetmore for good, but still I felt that shiver, as if the infection I'd been suffering with wasn't gone at all, but had only switched locations, from boiling my groin to freezing my backbone. Chapter 7
Come on, Brutal told Delacroix the following evening. We're going for a little walk, you and me and Mr. Jingles.
Delacroix looked at him distrustfully, then reached down into the cigar box for the mouse. He cupped it in the palm of one hand and looked at Brutal with narrow eyes.
What you talking about?
It's a big night for you and Mr. Jingles, Dean said, as he and Harry joined Brutal. The chain of bruises around Dean's neck had gone an unpleasant yellow color, but at least he could talk again without sounding like a dog barking at a cat. He looked at Brutal.
Think we ought to put the shackles on him, Brute?
Brutal appeared to consider.
No, he said at last. He's going to be good, ain't you, Del? You and the mouse both. After all, you're going to be showing off of some high muckamucks tonight.
Percy and I were standing up by the duty desk watching this, Percy with his arms folded and a small, contemptuous smile on his lips. After a bit, he took out his horn comb and went to work on his hair with it. John Coffey was watching, too, standing silently at the bars of his cell. Wharton was lying on his bunk, staring up at the ceiling and ignoring the whole show. He was still being good, although what he called good was what the docs at Briar Ridge called catatonic. And there was one other person there as well. He was tucked out of sight in my office, but his skinny shadow fell out the door and onto the green mile.
"What dis about you, grand fou?"
Del asked querulously, drawing his feet up on the bunk as Brutal undid the double locks on his cell door and ran it open. His eyes flicked back and forth among the three of them.
"Well, I'll tell you," Brutal said. "Mr. Moores is gone for a while. His wife is under the weather, as you may have heard. So Mr. Anderson is in charge, Mr. Curtis Anderson."
"Yeah? What that got to do with me?"
"Well," Harry said, "Boss Anderson's heard about your mouse, Del, and wants to see him perform. He and about six other fellows are over in admin, just waiting for you to show up. Not just plain old blue suit guards, either. These are pretty big bugs, just like Brute said. One of them, I believe, is a politician all the way from the state capitol."
Delacroix swelled visibly at this, and I saw not so much as a single shred of doubt on his face. Of course they wanted to see Mr. Jingles, who would not? He scrummed around, first under his bunk and then under his pillow. He eventually found one of those big pink peppermints and the wildly colored spool. He looked at Brutal questioningly, and Brutal nodded.
Yep, it's the spool trick they're really wild to see, I guess. But the way he eats those mints is pretty damn cute, too. And don't forget the cigar box you'll want it to carry him in, right?
Delacroix got the box and put Mr. Jingle's props in it, but the mouse he settled on the shoulder of his shirt. Then he stepped out of his cell, his puffed-out chest leading the way, and regarded Dean and Harry.
You boys coming?
Nah, Dean said. Got other fish to fry. But you knock him for a loop, Del. Show him what happens when a Louisiana boy puts a hammer down and really goes to work.
You bet.
A smile shone out of his face, so sudden and so simple in its happiness, that I felt my heart break for him a little, in spite of the terrible thing he had done. What a world we live in. What a world.
Delacroix turned to John Coffey, with whom he had struck up a diffident friendship, not much different from 100 other Death House acquaintances I'd seen.
"You knock 'em for a loop, Del," Coffey said in a serious voice. "You show 'em all his tricks."
Delacroix nodded and held his hand up by his shoulder. Mr. Jingles stepped onto it like it was a platform, and Delacroix held the hand out toward Coffey's cell. John Coffey stuck out a huge finger, and I'll be damned if that mouse didn't stretch out his neck and lick the end of it just like a dog.
"Come on, Del, quit lingering," Brutal said. "These folks are setting back a hot dinner at home to watch your mouse cut his capers."
Not true, of course. Anderson would have been there until 8 o'clock on any night, and the guards he'd dragged in to watch Delacroix's show would be there until 11 or 12, depending on when their shifts were scheduled to end. The politician from the state capital would most likely turn out to be an office janitor in a borrowed tie. But Delacroix had no way of knowing any of that.
"I'm ready," Delacroix said, speaking with the simplicity of a great star who has somehow managed to retain the common touch.
"Let's go."
And as Brutal led him up the green mile with Mr. Jingles perched there on the little man's shoulder, Delacroix once more began to bugle,
"Messieurs et mesdames, bienvenue au Cirque des Mousies!"
Yet, even lost as deeply in his own fantasy world as he was, he gave Percy a wide berth and a mistrustful glance. Harry and Dean stopped in front of the empty cell across from Wharton's. That worthy had still not so much as stirred. They watched as Brutal unlocked the door to the exercise yard, where another two guards were waiting to join him, and led Delacroix out, bound for his command performance before the grand high poobahs of Cold Mountain Penitentiary. We waited until the door was locked again, and then I looked toward my office. That shadow was still lying on the floor, thin as famine, and I was glad Delacroix had been too excited to see it.
"Come on out," I said, "and let's move along brisk, folks. I want to get 2 run-throughs in, and we don't have much time."
Old Toot Toot, looking as bright-eyed and bushy-tailed as ever, came out, walked to Delacroix's cell, and strolled in through the open door.
"Sitting down," he said. "I'm sitting down, I'm sitting down, I'm sitting down."
This is the real circus, I thought, closing my eyes for a second. This is the real circus right here, and we're all just a bunch of trained mice. Then I put the thought out of my mind, and we started to rehearse. Chapter 8. The first rehearsal went well, and so did the second. Percy performed better than I could have hoped for in my wildest dreams. That didn't mean things would go right when the time really came for the Cajun to walk the mile, but it was a big step in the right direction. It occurred to me that it had gone well because Percy was at long last doing something he cared about. I felt a surge of contempt at that and pushed it away. What did it matter? He would cap Delacroix and roll him, and then both of them would be gone. If that wasn't a happy ending, what was? And as Moores had pointed out, Delacroix's nuts were going to fry no matter who was out front. Still, Percy had shown to good advantage in his new role, and he knew it. We all did.
As for me, I was too relieved to dislike him much, at least for the time being. It looked as if things were going to go all right. I was further relieved to find that Percy actually listened when we suggested some things he could do that might improve his performance even more, or at least cut down the possibility of something going wrong.